Hi, and welcome to the Conservation and HD podcast series. Today we'll be exploring engaging people in hunting. I'm Kaylin Clements. I'm a social scientist in the Human Dimensions branch of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service at the Natural Resource Program Center in Fort Collins, Colorado. And also here with me today is Tyler Green.
Hello, I work with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service out of our Northeast region in our External Affairs program.
And this podcast is part of our effort to put tools and resources into the hands of natural resource practitioners and is a collaboration with the National Conservation Training Center.
So today we are talking to Eric Morris, who lives in Atlanta, Georgia, who is the founder of Black Wolf Hunting Club. Eric, can you say a few words?
Yes, hey, nice to be here on the call. I'm looking forward to providing any kind of input and engaging in the conversation because I think it's good that we're talking about a much needed subject and a grossly underlacking topic when it comes to hunting.
Thanks. We are also speaking with Lincoln Larson, a professor from the North Carolina State University who has performed research on this topic. Lincoln, do you want to say a few things?
Sure. Thanks for having me on the call. A lot of our work focuses on human dimensions and natural resource management, including hunting. So we're really excited to zoom in on this issue here today.
That's great. So before we get started, I want to just set a little bit of context about why we're having this conversation, why it's relevant and timely right now. So back in September, the Fish and Wildlife Service released the 2016 National Survey of Fishing, Hunting, and Wildlife Associated Recreation Report. It showed that 101.6 million Americans, or 40% of the U.S. population, ages 16 and older, participated in wildlife-related activities in 2016. This includes hunting, fishing, and wildlife watching. The survey overall illustrated gains in wildlife watching, particularly around people's homes and in fishing, with moderate declines in the number of hunters nationally.
So what we wanted to ask first off before we get more into your all's backgrounds is if you're aware of any other research more specific to engaging people in hunting and what's out there and what the trends reveal.
Well, I can grab that one. As someone who's done research in this field at both the local, state, and national scales in recent years, I can tell you that hunting is declining. There was a slight uptick from the 2011 survey, but general pattern since around 1980 is a slow and steady decline in the number of hunters nationwide. There's a number of potential explanations for that, but I'll add to it, too, that despite the fact that actual hunter numbers are declining, we see that public support for hunting is actually staying pretty level over time. And what we're starting to see is some shifts in the reasons people approve of hunting, or the reasons they think that hunting would be acceptable. Historically, there's been a stronger emphasis on the social benefits and connections you get from hunting with your buddies, your family. But more recently, there's been a shift towards thinking in hunting in terms of civic-oriented reasons, so maybe controlling wildlife populations causing problems for people, maybe a renewal of that conservation hunter as a conservationist ethos, so the wildlife management goals of hunting and ecosystem preservation, the balance you're looking for. And then, of course, meat has always been a root of hunting and why people hunt. But there's some new takes on meat, including the locavore movement. We can get into that a little bit later, too, as well. So you definitely see a decline. There's some different shifts and trends society-wise that are impacting this. We'll have some more time, hopefully, to talk about some of those.
Thanks. That's super interesting. Eric, did you want to add anything?
Yeah, from my perspective, a lot of my research has been from, kind of grassroots level, going to people's homes, mainly people of the minority community, and meeting with them, whether it be in their homes or in a rec center or wherever I can meet with them and asking them up front, hey, why don't you hunt? And a lot of information that I've gathered have been from people as young as, 12 or 13 up to 55 years old as to reasons why they don't hunt. It'd be pretty interesting to hear what Lincoln has to say because I have read a book where a researcher went to North Carolina, I think it was in the late 70s, where he conducted interviews with both black and white hunters. And a lot of those reasons as to why they hunted are still relevant today among us hunters. But like Lincoln said, though, hunting is on a decline across the board. And quite honestly, today's a different time. Back in the 50s and 60s, in the heyday of hunting back in the day, when a lot of our parents and grandparents were around. You know, things have changed. We have internet, we have all kinds of things to do other than hunt. So there's a lot of different factors as to why not as many people hunt today as they did a few decades ago.
Yeah, I wanted to take it back to something that really both of you said, maybe specifically you, Lincoln. So in the U.S., we've had this North American model of wildlife conservation, and that was really looked at. It's looked at as a sustainable way for us to manage and control wildlife populations. And maybe you'll talk about it a little bit later, but I wanted to know, have you come across anything where there shows that there's still support for that?
Not enough is my quick answer to that. And I can speak from my own personal experience with respect to that, in terms of understanding the role that hunting plays in conservation in this country. So I have a wildlife biology background. I've been passionate about conservation for a long time. I had a certain perception about hunting growing up. I came from a more urban area. My parents never hunted. I'd never even fired a gun until a couple of years ago. So hunting was one thing to me, and I dissociated it from conservation for a long period of time, just not really understanding the big picture. But as only as I got older and became more active in the conservation field and started to understand that you can't really have a conversation about conservation in the United States without talking about hunting and fishing, which have been the centerpiece of conservation and funding for conservation for a long time in this country. And so, you know, today I'm a Prius owner. I pretty much bike everywhere even with that. I don't really fit the traditional hunter mold, but when I start to think about the broader ecological, social, and economic benefits of hunting, many of which are linked to the North American model that you're describing, I wanted to learn much more about it, mm-hmm. and I wanted to learn how we could work within that framework to advance conservation culture in this country and hopefully kind of help it adapt to our modern times rather than keeping it back, you know, where it was a century ago. So it's a strong foundation, but the question is, and the question I keep asking is, how do we bring more people like me who don't understand that into the fold, and how do we adapt going forward? And so that's driven a lot of our research recently.
So Eric, how did you become interested in hunting, and can you tell us a little bit more about your background?
Yeah, sure, no problem. What interests me, what got me started in hunting, I can't tell you. I believe that hunters are sometimes born. And I don't say that to be, you know, boastful or anything like that, but I know I have been interested in hunting the outdoors since 5 years old, 6 years old. And ironically, like a lot of people, my parents didn't hunt. My daddy did not hunt. A couple of his brothers did, but I come from a non-hunting background. Although that doesn't mean that I did not hunt. As soon as I was able to get a pellet gun for Christmas, I would hunt around the neighborhood for squirrels and rabbits and things such as that. Whereas my daddy did not come from a, you know, wasn't a hunter. He did teach me how to shoot when I was 8. And so that was pretty much the norm in my family. Most kids in my family learn how to shoot early on, you know, when they're in second, third grade. So, you know, the interest, it just always has interested me to be out in the outdoors and to hunt. I realized, even from a child though, I realized that I never saw anyone on TV or, you know, in the media or anything that looked like me, that was a hunter. Mm-hmm. No black hunters to be found, or fishermen anywhere. And, you know, that was kind of understood when I was that age. But as I got older and started traveling around, you know, finished college and everything, and on my own, what really got me started into trying to make a difference and to take a serious approach, not just a mouthpiece approach, but a serious hands-on approach to getting more minorities involved in hunting, is the fact that when I would go places and, you know, to participate in a hunt, I get the deer in the headlights look. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people can't believe that I hunt. And when they ask me what did I hunt, the first thing they suggest is, okay, what do you hunt? Like, you know, rabbits, squirrels? I'm like, well, no, bear, buffalo, deer. And, you know, I got so tired of that look of disbelief, not only by white people, but by some black people too. You know, that I say, hey, I got to do something. You know, what can I do? A lot of us talk about it, you know, but I say, what can I do as a person to try to help solve the problem? So that's a little bit about my background and how mm-hmm. I got into it. And it's a lifelong journey for me, and a passion and a job as far as increasing diversity.
Yeah. And I think so you touched on some of the barriers that you know, we could face as we try to introduce and engage people in hunting. So I kind of wanted to flip it and then see from both of you if we could hear from you about some of the reasons that motivate people to become a hunter. Eric, you just touched on it a little bit, you know, like you feel some hunters are born, you know, your family playing a role, you were really young. So Lincoln, do you have anything to add there?
You know, I was listening to Eric, and I think it's really interesting because what he said encapsulates quite well what we found in some of our research. I'll give you an example. In a study we recently did across the state of New York, we looked at how non-traditional path hunters, so these would be typically people living in cities, it could be racial ethnic minorities, it could be women, people coming to hunting not without that traditional hunting look, no previous hunting experience, usually coming in as adults. How are they different than traditional hunters? And what can agencies do in response to that? And so we had some theories as to how they might differ. You know, are they coming for different reasons? Are they less excited about getting a big buck and more excited about the food element or whatever it is? And what we found is that no matter what you look like and where you come from, for the most part, you're out there hunting for pretty similar reasons. And it's often food-oriented. Connection to nature is a big part of it for a lot of people. There's the social community bonding aspect of it. And hunting is, although you think of, you know, somebody out in a tree stand or stalking on their own, it's a very social activity, and social motivations are a big part of it for a lot of people. And so those across the board, even for these non-traditionals, as Eric was saying, he's just a hunter in a lot of ways, so he wants to be looked at as a hunter and not necessarily as a black hunter, you know, per se. And so that's what we found in a lot of our research, too. And I think it is fascinating to think about the similarity, in some ways, to think about similarities versus differences when you consider some of that stuff.
Yeah, I'll say a couple more things along those lines. Lincoln mentioned that, you know, we have a lot of similarities. That is 100% true, because I have been in situations and have brought other people who were kind of skeptical about going into certain environments because the people looked like them, or that did not look like them, they didn't talk like them, they kind of were different. But once people understand that that hunting is that common bond or that common interest, it's almost like you found a newfound friend. And I've said that a lot. One of the things that I'll say, Lincoln, is that, you know, you mentioned that, you know, how do we get adults? A lot of people, you know, come in later on in life about hunting. I can see a lot about that. A lot of agencies right now are trying to figure out, hey, how do we get more minorities involved in hunting? They have different programs out there that they try, but from my perspective, they're going about it the wrong way. And here's what I mean by that. There's a lot of interest, a lot of warm and fuzzy feelings when it comes to teaching kids how to hunt and going out and finding a group of minority kids to take on the hunt, to get photographs with, to publish those photographs. But for the most part, that would be the only hunt that child would do. Why is that? The reason why is because the parents are not sold on it. The agencies have not engaged the parents. And for the hunts that I've taken people on, I've taken whole families on hunts, you know, husband, wife, kids and all. On Veterans Day, while some people are out celebrating our, veterans, history and everything like that, and our veterans, I was in the North Georgia mountains with a family, taking them on their very first hunt. But the thing is, a lot of agencies don't engage the parents. In the black community, I can say that because I am from the black community. If you don't have the parents, if you don't sell the parents on something that they have not been introduced to themselves, they're going to be very unlikely to let their kids go or to take their kids back again. So a lot of people that I have, that I reach out to, that have contacted me or I've contacted them, they're grown. They're in their 30s, 40s. The oldest guy today was 55 years old. They contacted me and said, hey, man, look, I saw an article on you in the paper, and I want you to stop by my office and, I want to talk to you. What he wanted to talk about was the fact that he was 55 years old, had always wanted to go hunting. In fact, he helped put some of the hunts together there in Kansas City for some of the urban hunts, but he had never gone hunting himself. He wanted someone like me to take him hunting. So that's something I can talk about a little bit later on, how sometimes the messenger is important. We always say that the message is more important than the messenger. However, and this is particularly true when I'm about to say when it comes to hunting, sometimes when it comes to hunting, the messenger is more important than the message, because we do have our stereotypes and we do have our paradigms that we live in, and so I think that it's something that we can do better as an industry if we're going to seriously bring about more diversity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And speaking of stereotypes, something me and Tyler kind of struggled with a little bit when we were creating or coming up with the idea for this discussion was, what are we looking at exactly? Who are we trying to engage and how? Is there a prescription for engaging urban audiences or minorities in hunting? And what we kind of decided, and especially after reading a little bit of Lincoln's research, is it's not so cut and dry like that. It's complex. It's a complex system. We originally called this podcast, engaging urban populations and hunting, or urban audiences and hunting, but maybe that's not the right approach. Maybe it's a lifestyle, and you can't put people in these boxes all the time. And I was wondering if you could speak to that a little bit, Lincoln, because I know that you have... Well, your writing helped me about social habitat of hunting. It helped me understand it a little better.
Yeah, I think you're spot on. I think a mistake that agencies could make trying to promote R3 and hunting in general is to assume that a one-size-fits-all approach is going to work. And I think that's the model that's been applied with a lot of existing programs. What works for white youth in rural communities is going to work for minorities in cities. And there are similarities in why people hunt, but clearly that's not the case. As Eric just said, people come to hunting, in some ways to forge their own identity, and that identity is not going to be universal across groups. So, while I do think we could have a united community in support of hunting and its role in wildlife conservation, there's not going to be a completely united front of hunters all on the same page, all sharing the same core values, all moving forward together. Mm-hmm. That's just not a reality. So that's going to require some adaptation and some diversity in terms of program delivery and what that looks like. So I think that's important to recognize. And I also think, and you mentioned the term social habitat, Kaylin, that is important. And the idea there is that, hunters don't exist in a vacuum. To Eric's point, it's about the family around them. It's about the community and the support networks they have around them. And there's higher level stuff going on at the landscape level. What are the access to hunting opportunities? And then at the social level, society, what policies are in place? What are institutions, what are wildlife agencies, for example, doing to portray hunting and to promote hunting in different ways? What role is the media playing? So all of these interacting factors are creating a social habitat that may be conducive to or detrimental to hunting. And the challenge for anyone attempting to promote hunting is that they have to understand all these intersecting factors at once and try to figure out a solution that will, if not accommodate them, at least acknowledge them. Mm-hmm. And it's not an impossible task, and that's why it takes people from the communities that understand what's going on to help lead the charge.
The biggest question we should start with, I think that we should frame the problem. And that problem is, how, do we get more minorities involved? How welcoming is the environment the environment that we're welcoming people into? Because, sometimes, we have a way that we see ourselves, but then people, and then we have a way that we want to be seen, but then sometimes those two don't match up with how other people see us. So when it comes to the different groups out there who say that, they want to bring about diversity, they want to have more inclusion, how is the target market viewing the people who are saying, hey, come out and try this, come out and do this? What is the target market seeing?
It's back to the who's the messenger kind of thing. And I think that plays a big role. I mean, we certainly, Eric, you've provided some great examples from your perspective. But I think, too, one of the, there's a lot of talk now about the locavore movement and how local foodies, who are often greenies, are coming into hunting from cities as adults, mm-hmm. because they want to provide for themselves and be one with the land and reduce their ecological footprint. And, there's certainly some momentum behind that locavore movement and some clear potential connections to hunting. But what we found is that locavores, that's the identity they value. It may not be, they don't really want to become hunters. They want to eat game meat, but they don't want to be seen as traditional hunters are seen, because that conflicts with how they present themselves and their social groups, too. So it presents an interesting challenge in terms of integrating locavores, how you go about that, how you find them, how you design programs that are going to encourage them to hunt for the reasons they want to hunt versus reasons others might want to hunt. And so I think it speaks to the diverse paths that people pursue on their way into hunting and how we have to be very cognizant of and sensitive to those different pathways and how we frame hunting and how we conduct hunting-related R3 programming.
I like what you're saying about those different values and identities, because that's something, you know, as a conservation social scientist and people in our field think about a lot. Okay, what are those values? And then, you know, we have this pyramid of these different motivations for our behavior and conservation. And so, that, you know, there's values, there's beliefs, there's attitudes, and then there's behavior. And we kind of think about, okay, well, there's stuff on the surface level that we might be able to influence, like attitudes, but we're probably never going to change someone's values. And I think that's really important to think about. And I really relate to what you're saying about the locavore movement, because I think that's where I get excited about hunting, because I'm like, I want to know where my food comes from and I want to be part of that chain instead of just buying meat from a grocery store.
You bring up R3, and I think that's really important. So can you just tell us a little bit more about that? And then, Eric, I think that pretty much taps into exactly what you do. So can we talk a little bit about R3 and what that is?
Sure, R3, I thought we'd reference it before. I apologize for throwing it out there without a foundation. Recruitment, retention, and reactivation of hunters. So it's basically what does the future trajectory of hunting look like, and how can we use those three R's to encourage a sustainable flow of hunters, more or less. And one thing you mentioned, locavores, made me think of it in terms of how is this, you know, how do we apply this on the ground? If you invite a couple of locavores to a traditional R3 or Hunter Ed workshop, and they're surrounded by people who aren't like them and are thinking differently than they do, that's not necessarily a welcoming experience. It may be off-putting. It may never come back. You organize a workshop where locavores, if I can use that term again, are surrounded by like-minded people from cities with no previous hunting experience, it's a lot more comfortable. And we see that some of the workshops around the country in various states where people are doing this and evaluating it, those can be more productive in terms of long-term hunting participation because people feel like they belong, mm-hmm. and that can be really important.
Well, what I was going to say earlier is that, I don't know if I've been up on a rock or just out of tune with the terminology, but I haven't heard of locavore. That's new to me. I understand the concept, listen to you, I understand that. I just haven't heard that before. One thing that I would say is that from the people that I've reached out to, regardless of they're from the white community or the black community, who don't hunt, who have an interest in hunting. Most have an interest in hunting because they want to. I mean, hunting is a skill. Hunting is for most people will see and understand that hunting, it takes something to go out into the woods, find something, kill something, and put it on the table. Whereas a lot of people won't just come up and tell you, say, hey, man, this is what I want to do. Once you start talking to them and tell them, you know, how important it is to hunt and to be able to hunt, they identify what that is. They look, hey, there's something I need to be able to do. Particularly some parents who have kids, some men, and even some women who have kids. A lot of them want to be able to go out and do that and teach their kids how to do it. So I'm working with people now who just started hunting, you know, within the last couple of years. They want to learn all they can so that way when they have kids, they can go out and teach them the same skill. But again, the term locavore is unique. But most people that I have talked to on all economic levels, they want to be able to go out and provide for themselves to be self-sufficient. That's a big thing for most people that I've talked to.
Yeah, I want to hit on that. You know, you talked about just like the kind of, I guess, like the courage that it takes to go hunting. And I kind of want to talk a little bit about barriers and what some barriers to engagement are for hunting, especially in urban areas. Lincoln, have you come across any research or conducted anything that gets at that? And then Eric, in your experience, working with folks who, you know, grew up in urban areas and then are getting introduced to hunting, what are some of those barriers that you had to overcome or that they faced, you know, going through that journey?
Yeah, I can kick that off. We've certainly looked at some barriers or constraints to hunting, why people don't do it at all or as often as they'd like. Looking both at the traditional hunter and kind of the non-traditional path hunters, the urbanites or minorities we're talking about here. And, you know, it's aside from some obvious things, one being lack of access to hunting land near cities versus in rural areas where it's much more abundant throughout the country, they're pretty similar across the board. A lot of times it's issues out of the individual's control, whether it's how much time, free time they have, how, you know, equipment costs and barriers. Sometimes it has to do with firearm laws in their respective states, depending on where they are. And a lot of that stuff, you know, is beyond the individual. But I think that some common things, too, that you look at socially is that the importance of mentors. So are there people around them that they can go with? And I think that's more common in rural areas. There's obviously larger hunting populations there, less common in cities, and can be harder to find. And so that can be a more significant barrier there as well. When you don't have, say, a family network you're used to hunting with, you've got to find a friend or a coworker or some of the connections Eric's talking about. And that can be challenging. And then just the idea, also, if you're from non-hunting communities, how others would perceive you if you're hunting. And that's something else that's a little bit different as well in more urban areas where fewer people are hunting versus rural areas, and what that does to your ability to hunt and your interest and motivation to hunt. So in general, there are a lot of similarities between the groups, but there are a few different types of constraints that we see coming out on both state and national levels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're reminding me of that saying, it takes a hunter to make a hunter. And so how do you kind of replicate that in order to overcome that barrier?
You know, I would amend that statement. I think, generally speaking, research and anecdotal evidence would undoubtedly suggest that that is important and mentoring is critical. But I think what Eric's saying today and what I'm hearing as the conversation progresses is it really takes a certain type of hunter to create a certain type of hunter. So mm-hmm. That's what I get. The one-size-fits-all doesn't necessarily work, and the messenger is key. And the identity you're pursuing or the type of hunting, it's also key, the reason people are hunting. So I do think that applies, but I think we have to think more carefully about who those hunters are and why other people might be drawn to hunting when we make a blanket statement like that.
I would say either drawn to hunting or pushed away from hunting, because it can go both ways.
Mm-hmm.
And from my perspective, you know, because I deal in the grassroots, you know, right in people's living rooms sometimes, addressing, you know, their real world concerns when it comes to hunting. And some of the barriers that I've seen are, you know, they're obvious, you know, that there is a big, and people don't like to talk about it. But in order to bring about change, you got to talk about it and acknowledge the fact that in our country, we have racial issues that are sometimes, a lot of people see them as barriers. Now, with that being said, I will also say that sometimes people create racial issues or something may not really be an issue, but they see it that way. What do I mean by that? Here's what I mean. A lot of guys and women I've talked to, they have been invited to go hunting by white hunters. On one particular case, the white hunter actually bought the guy a gun. The guy did not know it, but the white hunter bought him a gun and was going to give it to him. But because of everything that has gone on in our country, and some things that still pop up, the black hunter backed out. And a lot of, black hunters who have opportunities to go hunting with some white hunters, a lot of them, more than too many, in my opinion, choose not to go for various reasons. I'm not going to say obvious reasons. I'll say various reasons. So one of the things I try to tell people is this. Going back to that, it takes a special kind of hunter. And going back to that one guy that was 55 years old and invited me to come by and talk to him and to take him hunting. When I told that the guy, I said, look, you know, I said, first of all, I'll be happy to take you or anyone hunting and teach you how to hunt and how to be an ethical hunter. Two, I know that you have had plenty of opportunities to go hunting in your lifetime long before you saw the article that was written about me a couple weeks ago. And a lot of those people that probably gave you opportunities were white hunters. And he said, like I've heard many time and time again by other hunters, yeah, I have, but I'd rather go with somebody that looked like you. So there's a trust issue within the black community. And I guess I can go on and on with actually, you know, stories of things that I've been told and things I've heard, but when it comes to barriers, you know, that's one. You know, the racial issues/perceptions. too. A lot of people would like to believe that blacks and other minorities don't hunt because of the cost associated with hunting. But what I found, that's not true. Blacks and minorities make, you know, good money, a lot of money in a lot of areas of the country. They just choose to spend it on other things that they identify with. Until we can get black hunters and other minority hunters identified with hunting, they're not going to go out and spend $300 or $400 for a rifle. They're not going to go buy a hunting lease or buy a hunting license. So we have to show them, you know, some people want to know, hey, what's in it for me? Show them the benefits of hunting. And what I tend to do is show people that, hey, you know, how much does a pair of Air Jordans cost? One guy said like $260 a few years ago. Mm-hmm. I said, hey, for $260, you can buy yourself a gun that'll add to a lifetime, passing on to your grandkids. Mm-hmm. You're 15 years old right now. You spend $260 on a pair of shoes. You can't wear them 2 years from now because your feet got too big. So once you break it down and show it, you know, yes, you know, for those who have a hard time seeing it that way, once you show them that, hey, you know, it's not an issue of finances. It's not an issue of not knowing where to go. You have to first be introduced to it and show, hey, you know, here's what hunting is about. Here's where you will benefit from hunting. Mm-hmm. Then you'll see more people coming forward saying, you know what, hey, I want to do that. Instead of me going to do this vacation this summer or do whatever I'm going to do, let me go and try hunting. And so I think that, you know, I think the easy way out and the thing that a lot of people do is say, well, they can't afford it. Oh, they don't know where to go. You know, those types of things. In my opinion, now, let me back up. There will always be a certain segment of the population that applies to, always. But I think more times than not, there are plenty of, people who are financially able and want to go hunting that just haven't been introduced or don't feel comfortable going with the people that are trying to introduce them.
So you touched on a lot of things there. One thing I kind of want to take us back a little bit and talk about that piece where making sure that folks recognize, even if they don't hunt, like recognizing what they can do, what does it do for me? That's what it is for a lot of people. When you look at conservation across the board or any issue really is, why do I care? What's in it for me? And so I'm wondering from both of you, what have you found, like what is in it for people? Even if I don't hunt, if I'm never going to hunt, I still want to make sure that I understand the importance that opportunity is out there for people who do want to engage in that activity. And then also we have this flip side that it's not just that sport piece of it, but it also contributes to conservation. So, I mean, I can talk a little bit about that, but I definitely want to hear from you guys on that.
I'll go back to the national survey looking at reasons people approve of hunting, and we see that the top reasons are really kind of the civic purpose, hunting against the controlling wildlife populations for the benefits of people, conservation hunting, you know, reducing overabundant wildlife populations, and then the meat thing is huge. And I'd say, too, that what we find through a lot of our research, even if it's only, you know, 5 to 15%, depending on who you ask when, of the total U.S. population hunts, and most of that's in rural areas, so very small fraction. There is a much larger percentage of the population, including rural and urban areas, that is associated with hunting in some way, shape, or form. Even if they're not grabbing any sort of firearm or other implement and head into the field, they've got friends who are sending them venison. You know, they might be cooking that game meat. They might be sharing stories about it with others. So hunting casts a much larger web than just, you know, license buying hunters. And I think that's important for agencies to think about, too, and managers to think about. We're not just talking about communication with a group of active hunters. We're talking about interacting with, informing, educating, responding to the needs and the questions of a much larger population of hunting associates, too. And if we can accommodate all those things, it's much better for the world of hunting and wildlife conservation in general.
I guess what I was trying to get at, too, with that question, I kind of want to tease out a little more is, so for instance, the Fish and Wildlife Service has the federal duck stamp, and 98% of sales of duck stamp go back to conserve wetland habitat that become part of our refuge system. There's more places to hunt, et cetera. However, at the same time, beyond that, what that land does is also provide something for you, even if you don't hunt, like clean air, clean water. It's a, like, refuges can be storm buffers. Have you ever seen that? Have you ever seen people make that connection? Because you said at the beginning of this, Lincoln, is that it's hard to talk about conservation without talking about the role and the importance of anglers and hunters.
Yeah, I mean, I think I think there are two questions that when we think about this topic, there are two broader questions here to think about. What are we trying to do? What's the real goal here if we're talking about R3 and promoting hunting? Is the goal to create more active hunters, with the caveat that, you know, adds to, or the corresponding with hunting license sales, equipment purchases that fund conservation, duck stamp, for example, any of Pittman Robertson funding, any of that stuff. So do we just want more active hunters, or do we want to enhance awareness and create more hunting advocates, thereby generating broader policy support for wildlife conservation? So not just the dollar values, but just the conservation ethos that is more present throughout society. And I think that both of those are viable goals. And I don't think you can have long-term sustainability of the first, the actual active hunters, without cultivating the second. And I'll give you an example. Duck stamps, which you referenced. So we did a survey of birders, Audubon members, in the Christmas bird count, and asked them how many of them buy duck stamps. And it was about, I think it was about 20% of them, but a lot of those ones that did were waterfowl hunters. And it was only a very small fraction of birders out of a sample of thousands that purchased a duck stamp with no interest in waterfowl hunting just because they recognized the value that it contributed to habitat management more broadly, those bigger picture things that you're talking about, Tyler. So these are very engaged birders who have a good grasp of wildlife conservation, and it's only less than 10% of them understand that that's a way to contribute. So I think that, no, people don't really do it for the purpose very often, but I think that if wildlife agencies did a better job of communicating broader benefits, or just through different mechanisms, I mean, I know they spend a lot of time and effort on that, but we talk about diverse publics and diverse engagement, that would help to the larger message about the importance of hunting and what it does for habitat generally. It would help to spread that word a little bit more.
I think that most hunters who or people who have interest in hunting, if they see and understand that, hey, you know, you're going to pay this much for a hunting license, you're going to pay this much for a duck stamp, but guess what? The money, a portion of that money you're spending is going into making sure that you will have a place to hunt in the future. I think most people can swallow that pill okay. But again, you mentioned, Lincoln, that some of the people there in the room who didn't even hunt bought duck stamps. I think that's pretty impressive. I didn't know that many people was actually, you know, supporting the outdoors in that way. But you also mentioned something in the conversation that you know, a lot of people may not be pro hunters or for hunting that, you know, support the outdoors. But the thing I've learned as a hunting education instructor is that more, you know, you have a percentage. I think you said 15% of the population hunts. That means that there's a lot of non-hunters out there. The thing that I learned and I teach people through hunter education is that although the people may be a non-hunter, they may not be anti-hunting. What makes them anti-hunting is how we as hunters conduct ourselves. You know, so there's a lot of hunting etiquette that goes into that. So I'm okay with the fact that, you know, hunters may, you know, may be outnumbered by the non-hunters, as long as those non-hunters aren't anti-hunting. You know, and so I think that, you know, we as outdoorsmen and hunters play a big portion in that. You know, how are we seen as hunters? What is people's perceptions of us as hunters?
You know, if the conversation is about hunting, is really about how we're generating funding to support wildlife conservation efforts, then I think we have to think beyond hunting and think about, you know, all the non-consumptive, you referenced the study, the 2016 survey. We got a lot of non-consumptive wildlife recreationists out there who aren't hunters, who aren't anglers, but who are excited about wildlife recreation and potentially contributing to conservation through the right mechanisms if they were in place. So I know that's a whole different podcast if we want to talk about expanding conservation funding mechanisms in this country, but it should be part of the conversation if you think about, you know, what are we really aiming for here?
I wanted to know, right, like, so if there's, you know, someone else out there in New York City who is saying, I haven't hunted, they've heard this, what's the first step for them to take if they want to get involved in this? Maybe they don't have, you know, a close family member or a friend that knows the ins and outs well. What's a first step or first few steps that you'd recommend that they take to get engaged in the sport?
The first step is to get their hunter education. That's the first step. You have to have your hunter education before you even go on the hunt. And a lot of people, what I've learned is that a lot of the people who are interested in hunting, who don't hunt right now, they're on the forums, they're on the different websites and checking out different things like that. But what I would recommend is that, well, one, as soon as a person realizes that, hey, I think that I may want to be a hunter or try hunting, go get your hunter education. Take a traditional class, because you have an option. You have a online option and you have a traditional class option. By all means, I recommend the traditional class. That is where you go sit down in the class for a day or 2 days, however long it is in the state that they're from, and get hands-on, in-person, live feedback. I know that in our society right now, everything is online, kind of sort of in your own little bubble doing your thing, but I guarantee that a person who takes an online class will learn a quarter of what somebody will learn when they're in a traditional class. So once you get your education, start associating it and reaching out to people who you know that hunt. I'm only one guy, and I try to stretch myself as thin as I can to take people out hunting and to show them how to hunt. But there's other people out there that would be willing to take the time to teach you how to hunt. So there are ways to get involved with hunting, you know, several ways.
Yeah, we always joke about, talk with state agency folks in different states is, man, they really need a mesh.com for hunters. Because how else would you find mentors if you're not from one of those in-groups? You know, mm-hmm. You're really excited, but you don't have the connections. There are mechanisms. The good thing about technology, there's some bad things. And I don't know about the merits of the online hunter ed. I mean, I know that's it's growing in prominence in states for a number of reasons. I haven't seen any studies yet about the efficacy of that versus the traditional face-to-face. But I have to believe that face-to-face, given the opportunity, would be better. But yeah, I mean, I think that it's how do you develop a program like that with hunter ed being the gateway? How do you create it in a way that's welcoming for different groups? That's, I guess you could say, culturally competent or sensitive to different reasons and backgrounds and why people are coming, rather than this, you know, here's a traditional view. We all have to comply with the standard somehow. Yeah, there's some certain things that need to be met, but you can think about how that information is conveyed and in what way and by whom. And then thinking about beyond that, fostering those opportunities. And I don't know if that's the job of the state agency to create mentoring networks or if that's something that happens more organically through social media and hunting clubs like yours, Eric. But I think that that's something that really has to happen for that initial interest to become sustained engagement.
Well, here's one thing I was saying. Going back to what I mentioned earlier in the podcast about how a lot of agencies focus on the kids, I want to bet at least my pinky finger that there's never been an event that's, you know, how a lot of agencies say, you know, just a kids hunt, bring out the youth hunt, bring the kids out. How many agencies out there have done that for grown men and women? Hmm. Probably none. But quite honestly, I believe that a lot of times people look at it and say, hey, they're grown, they got a job, they can find their own place to hunt. I look at it completely different. I set up hunts just for adults to go out because, going back to what I said earlier, if you don't get the adults, if the adults don't know, if the adults aren't sold, they're going to be less likely to support their kids if the kids want to do it. Because if your child wanted to go and be a hang glider person, and you ain't never seen a hang glider, don't even know where to go to get a class from hang gliding, how likely are you going to let your child go do that? So again, I think that there's a lot that we can do in the outdoor industry, in the hunting industry. There's a lot, but we got to get away from the shooting cuddly stuff with kids and realize that, hey, if we're serious about, you know, making an impact and getting more diversity out there, but that set up some adult hunt dates for people who are new to hunting. I guarantee it'd be a success.
Fantastic point about the emphasis on youth clinics. Quick example of that: in South Carolina, we evaluated some of their youth clinics, and they're great programs that are run really well. The kids love them. They get a lot of great experience out of it, great hunting skills. But if you look at the kids enrolled, oh man, it's like 90% or more come from families with hunting backgrounds. So you are not recruiting a single new hunter from that pool. These are people who are doing it anyway. I'm not suggesting that we should disband youth hunting clinics totally, because they certainly have a lot of value. Mm-hmm. But that's not the way to get new hunters into the fold. Mm. And you have to be more strategic about it using some of the strategies Eric just mentioned.
Well, thank you so much, Eric and Lincoln. I appreciate you being on this call with us and recording with us today. If our listeners have any questions or would like to follow up, could they contact you?
Sure, no problem. They can contact me anytime. ITISEMMO@hotmail.com. That's my personal email. if they have an interest in hunting, or if needed any, you know, I guess advice or anything like that, mm-hmm. or have any questions for me, they can feel free to email me at my email address. We are on Facebook. Most people are on Facebook. And we do have a page on Facebook, which is Black Wolf Hunting Club on Facebook.
Okay, awesome. And Lincoln, what about you?
Yeah, so if anyone out there is interested in learning more about how to foster a diverse population of hunters and hunting advocates through diverse thinking and approaches, our research is all about that. We've got a new project that just launched looking at colleges and universities across the country in 13 different states, working with state agencies to understand college students and their connection to hunting and what we can learn from diverse college students and different pathways into hunting. Mm-hmm. So I'm happy to talk about all this stuff. Easiest way to reach me is through email, lrlarson, L-A-R-S-O-N, at ncsu.edu. And if you look me up on our webpage, you'll see our website and that sort of thing, too. But I'm happy to talk more about this. It's a fascinating issue and one that's really important for the future of conservation in our country. So thanks again for having me today.
Oh, yeah. Awesome discussion. I'm really excited to share this with all of our colleagues and the conservation community. I had a lot of fun and I learned a lot. And by the way, all podcasts can be found on the NCTC podcast page, which you can find by Googling NCTC podcasts. You can download and listen later, maybe in your car. That's what I like to do. Or stream it online using Internet Explorer. You also can be notified of new podcasts by subscribing on iTunes. Just search Human Dimensions and Conservation in the podcast iTunes store, and when you scroll down, the podcast episodes will be available. If you have ideas for future podcast topics, please email the HD branch at human_dimensions@fws.gov. Until next time, enjoy listening.